Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Gerard Atching. I'm the Director of Africana Studies and Research Center, and it's a real pleasure to welcome you all here today. And for me, it's all about gratitude this afternoon. We would like to thank our very special guest, Mr. Danny Glover. Extend a welcome to him. We'd like to welcome him and thank him for his generosity, and I mean generosity because he's been here all day. He's done a couple of classes over at the School for Industrial and Labor Relations, spent time with some youth downtown through the Greater Ithaca Activity Center. He's here at our event at Africana, and afterwards he'll be going to Ujamaa, the residential college, and all of this, and he's not even running for office. We're also grateful that Rick Hurd, the Associate Dean for External Relations at ILR, contacted us and encouraged us to put on this cooperative, well, effort, in fact. It's also a pleasure to be working with Professor Sabine Henny, Professor of Film and American Studies, who also is acting chair of the Department of Performance and Media Arts. In fact, she was able to arrange for two films to be shown last night, and two films that were produced by Mr. Glover and L'Ouverture Films, and those were the Black Power mixtape, 1967 to 75, that came out last year, and Bamako, 2005. In short, we're very pleased to be partnering with other campus units to hold events such as this one, and we look forward to more endeavors of this kind across campus in the future. If you look around as well, you'll see tangible evidence that people have worked hard to facilitate this event. I am thinking, of course, of our staff here at Africana, Renee Milligan, and especially Treva Levine, who kept on top of the scores of email messages and tasks that an event like this generates. So thank you. And of course, thank you to our ushers who are here to put us in our places. We are very fortunate to have three wonderful interlocutors who will engage Mr. Glover in conversation regarding the theme of today's event. The theme, of course, is race, activism, and art. And the title came about by putting our heads together to draw from our respective constituencies and fields, but also because an important issue such as the relationship between activism and art already emerged in the lecture series that we began here at Africana, a lecture series that we have called Freedom, Citizenship, and Democracy. So this is my plug for you to look out for more events this year. And let me tell you that Mr. Glover's interlocutors are Mark Bayard, who's at the far end there, the Executive Director of the Work Institute at ILR, Professor Sabine Henny, who I just introduced, and our own Professor Noliwe Rooks, Associate Professor of Africana Studies, and also Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies. We thank them for their willingness to be here this afternoon, and I'll just let you know that the format is quite simple. It's supposed to be a conversation. Nothing more formal than that, nothing more planned than that. So we'll let that roll. But allow me to introduce Mr. Bruce Rayner first, former president of several unions and also a member of Cornell's Board of Trustees, who will introduce Mr. Glover at greater length. Thank you very much, and please enjoy this interlude with Mr. Danny Glover. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and congratulations on your new position. We're all very pleased about that and the role of Africana at Cornell. It's my pleasure to introduce Danny. Danny's had a long day so far here, and we got here. We drove up here from New York City at 1. We got here at 1:30 in the morning. Danny was busy competing with President Obama at some event in the United Nations in New York. And we stopped at a convenience store in Whitney Point. Around 1 o'clock in the morning, we finally found one that was open. And we went in, and Danny just wanted a cold drink. And about a half an hour and 32 photographs and autographs later from everybody in the convenience store, we got back on the road. And Danny said we shouldn't have stopped. Danny Glover's a remarkable person in many ways. Everyone knows him as one of America's foremost film actors. He's appeared in some 70 films. And also a producer and director of documentary films, more than a dozen of those, many award-winning films. And so Danny's one of the preeminent American actors. But he's also much more than that. He's been in many ways, he's been an example of what I think prominent people in American society don't do enough, which is to use their fame and fortune and notoriety for causes that benefit mankind. And Danny has been one of America's leading activists for his entire career. He comes out of San Francisco State University, where he was a student activist. At the same time, the students agitated to create Africana Studies at Cornell. Danny and his cohorts at San Francisco State were doing the same thing and actually created another institution, which Danny can tell you about himself. So he's been an activist ever since he was a college student and throughout his career. He is the chair of an organization called the Trans Africa Forum, which is a black global justice organization that was the leading voice against the apartheid regime in South Africa. He remains as chairman of Trans Africa. He's done work in countries around the world, Africa, South America, on behalf of working people, on behalf of democracy, on behalf of addressing people's problems. And from one end of North America to the other, he's been a trade union activist, picket lines, organizing campaigns. We've shared numerous struggles. We got arrested a couple of times together. So I've been to jail with Danny. And the irony of going to jail with Danny, we were arrested in a particular demonstration in Maryland. And the cops put us in the back of a van. And then one of them said, you know, Mr. Glover, I hate to bother you at a time like this, but could I get your autograph? Danny said, well, it's a little hard. You got me handcuffed. So the guy, oh, I'm sorry, and he took off the handcuffs. And then Danny said, you're not going to put them back on again after I sign it. And the guy said, no. So Danny sat without his handcuffs. He's a remarkable activist that set an example in my mind of what people ought to do when they've achieved what he's achieved. He does all the stuff. Someone asked me today, Danny's up here. Danny doesn't accept a nickel to go down and talk to students or in downtown Ithaca who are 5 years old or talk to Cornell College students. He does it because he believes it's his role to make this world a better place to live. If we had more people like Danny Glover, it would be a better place to live. So it's my pleasure to introduce my good friend, Danny Glover.
They wouldn't tell how long I've known you. A child.
I've known him a long time.
Known each other a long time, you know. I just wanted, I'm saying we're going to cut to the chase and we're going to start just kind of asking questions from the audience or asking questions from here, from those who are part of this panel. Nalouwei, Mark, and I'm sorry.
Sabine.
All right, Sabine. What a great moment to be here. It's been really a hectic week, and I didn't want to even waste time talking about that week. We had the release of a very special film in at MoMA and in New York and also in Los Angeles, a film that we produced on the war on drugs, The House I Live In, directed by Eugene Durecki. And we think it is gonna be a very, very, very important vehicle. And I think the joy of my career is had the opportunity to be able to support those films. Or not only films, but also directors in ways that began to shift the discourse with his Black Power mixtapes, which is, in some sense, my youth, you know, coming of age as a young student at San Francisco State College, and where I saw people who I had only a few years before as a child, meeting them who I had kind of like they were my role models, like Ralph Featherstone or Stokely Carmichael or H.R.A.P. Brown or all these people who I had followed as a child as they were part of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you know, in the early 60s. Now I'm here standing against the wall in their presence, you know. And so we say, well, what'd you do? I said, I just stood against the wall and tried to remember every book they referenced to go out and buy it and read it, basically. But from that to really, when we look at my theatrical career and the choices that I made early on, I found me inexplicably connected to the anti-apartheid movement. From 1975, 1976, I began doing the work of Athol Fugard, the great South African playwright. It not only grounded me, it taught me several things. The craft of acting itself is you only learn to act by doing the work of great artists, whether it's Lorraine Hansberry, or whether it's Arthur Miller, or whether it's Shakespeare, or whatever. But also, more importantly about Fugard's work and great work, you decide as an actor what's important to you in the world and whose side in the world you're on. And those reinforce all those things that had come to me as a result of my experience as a child growing up, watching my young parents navigate through the new experience of living in San Francisco, working in their union, working, raising a family, and having their ear and their involvement in some way shaped around the civil rights movement as well, and growth around the civil rights movement, you know. So those are the kind of things that began to kind of put those things to place, whether it's the house I live in, or it's Bamako, or about the African debt crisis, a narrative about the African debt crisis, or as our first film, our first documentary was Africa United after Bob Marley's documentary on Bob Marley that we did in 2004, we shot. And or the other ideas of doing a documentary on Frantz Fanon, we've been working on a film about the relationship between Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein. They both were co-chairs of the anti-lynching campaign in 1946. Or the films that we're engaged in now in terms of the film that we're doing with Naomi Klein that I'm executive producing with Robert Redford on climate debt. And the film that we're also doing a documentary on arms sales. And the proliferation of all arms sales, illegal arms sales around the world. So all of the kind of things. And subsequently, the people I've met, you know, in around the world, filmmakers from all around the world, whether it's Egyptian filmmakers or filmmakers from the continent that I've met and an opportunity to meet. Those are the things that have certainly shaped the framework shaped some of the ideas that have helped me grow as well.
Well, I get to ask the first question, I guess, and you actually already kind of started to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
I know how important your family is mm-hmm. to you, those that have transitioned and those who are here.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually wanted to just begin by hearing you talk a little bit about how your family, you know, the theme for tonight is race, art, and activism.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did your family prepare you to have some of the views or prepare you to navigate in those different spaces that we most know you for?
Well, it's funny because I was just recently, my mother this year would have been 92 years old. And I was at a reunion some years back and with some of the classmates from Payne College. Part of my moral conditioning as a child was that my mother always said that she would be eternally grateful for her mother and father because she didn't pick cotton in September. She went to school in September. So consequently, my mother graduated from Payne College in Augusta, Georgia in 1942. And also in the class was Louis Lomax, the writer, also graduated from Payne College as well. And so that kind of was the bearing that you sensed in a way, this a sense of hard work and of overcoming. My mom was the regional president of the National Council of Negro Women, so she was very, very close to Dr. Dorothy Hythe. In fact, when we were sitting together at some years after as she had passed away, we were sitting at a table at the Black Caucus talking about her. She started crying, I started crying. So my mom was I think more than else that there's something about her, there's something she never said to me, and I learned this out at the Crafts Reunion, that in her wish thing on her graduation from college, she dreamed of being an actress, which she never was. So it was so fitting in some sense that I ended up living through her dream, living out her dream in some way, you know. My dad was absolutely, without a doubt, the most beautiful man I ever met in my life. He just had such ease and calm and patience. It's a beauty. And I'm a foot taller than my father. And I remember when I got arrested, I had spent the summer when I was 16 years old, me and my friends, we were hot-wiring those Zespa motor scooters running around the city like we owned them and everything else. And I got arrested on one, and my dad came to pick me up at the jail. And I was all huffed up. Of course, he has to look up to me. And I was all huffed up and everything ready. And he just came in as he put me up and said, "Son, I'm so disappointed in you." It's like he had to drag me off the ground, you know, the last thing I wanted to do. But they were, they were that. We were a family of five children. And we were only Glovers in the whole phone book in San Francisco when I was a kid growing up. There were no other Glovers in the phone book, you know. And so there was that small family and the kind of nurturing that family provided, you know. We all felt, and I think as children, as young kids, that we were all, the separation between, and delineation between parent and children was defined, definitely. But all of us did the things around the house, you know. I mean, I first started ironing clothes when I was 9 years old. You know, we cooked around the house. And everyone cooked. You know, there was no delineation between gender in terms of I had to mop the floor, I had to cook, I had to wash clothes, I had to iron clothes, I had to wash dishes and all those things, as well as my other brothers, particularly the first three of us who were merely, we were 3 years apart in years. Mm-hmm. We were 3 years from me and my youngest brother, my brother Reginald, Connie, Reginald were the first three. 3 years gone. So that kind of cohesiousness, you know. But more than anything else, and my mother adored her parents. I mean, there was a kind of commitment to her parents, you know. So we would make a trip, first of all, from San Francisco. I remember 1954, a trip that we made to Georgia. They took their vacation. It would invariably come up to New York because my mother's cousins and uncles, they lived in New York. That's the migration pattern from Georgia to New York, and which is also where my mother met my father in New York City. Their first date was to see Adam Clayton Powell Jr. speak. Mm-hmm. And so so all of that becomes a part of the center focus of, of my early life. Then you're born in a city like San Francisco. So just the idea of movement, the legacy of great movements. I remember when I was a kid, there was a big demonstrations around auto roll, getting them to hire African Americans in the auto, you know, the auto dealership business. All those things had an enormous impact on my sensibilities, you know. And so I ended up at San Francisco State in the spring of 1967. And that year we invited, Amiri Baraka out to San Francisco State for a semester. And his objective was a community communication program. So the idea of art, community, and the communication. So we had a program in which we used the old Fillmore Auditorium, place where I had saw Bobby Blue Bland and all the Motown Review and everything. We used that as the place. We got Bill Graham to let us use that space at that year. And we had poetry, you know, so the poets who would read, one of the poets that would read was Huey P. Newton and other poets that would read. We had dance, we had theater, and Amiri came up into the office one day, and he said, in the BSU office, he said, I want some of you so-called revolutionary brothers to be in these plays. And so we followed the path. And the Melanie and I did the play. I went to a play since I struggled and was intimidated a long time by the idea of auditioning. I went to do a play by a woman named Dorothea Mott called Papa's Daughter. It was one of the local writers there. And I did the play and everything else, and the play went so well, I had never been on stage before. I was 20 years old, I had never been on stage before. I did the play, and I all of a sudden I became the Minister of Culture for the Central Committee of the BSU. So it was that kind of, those are the kind of things that I think were important in my own evolution. But that period, that 3 years, and I thought about that as I was on campus, was such an intense 3 years, you know, from the Gator incident in the fall of 1967, where we got in a fight with the editor of the Gator newspaper, and we all ended up being a couple of us. I was suspended for 6 months for a semester. Some people were kicked out, a couple of were expelled from school and everything else, to the strike in 1968. And I bring that up because even though some of my friends may preach some revisionist history, but it took the BSU fighting to be able to declare a coalition that led to the Third World Coalition and the student strike itself, in the middle of the student strike. Because we had brought Nathan Hare out to San Francisco State in the fall of 1967, and part of the argument is that the university refused to rehire him for the 1968, the fall of 1968, and so we had been propositioning the university to make sure that we had a contract, and they had told us that they were simply, we were going to do that, don't worry about this, or just stonewall us at some certain point. And then we decided to call the strike. And in calling the strike, we found that in some ways that the opportunities for other organizations to form a coalition became so great. Even teachers would form the coalition in 1968, and basically we ended up shutting the campus down for 5 months, you know. Most of us ended up on trial in the spring, was conspiracy, you know, intent to incite riots and all of those kind of things that we ended up in trial on in terms of that. But it was one of the great lessons in my life of also coalition politics and effective coalition politics. And we engaged the community without community support. But San Francisco State was unique in some sense, and I'm saying it's only because it's a teacher's college. We had access to, and the number of black students was very small. We had access to a tutorial program which had 13 centers around the Wedgecombe. They were used as work-study projects for those who were potentially going to be teachers. Logical, in some sense. The BSU quickly took over that part of those programs and basically began to find, build these coalitions and community. So we were out from the spring of 1967, out meeting with community organizations. And at the time, the Western Addition, which is the major black community, the Fillmore District, was going through gentrification, or what they call redevelopment. And people began to mobilize. So what we found ourselves doing is aligning ourselves in the community with those issues. Now we have bridged our relationship with the community through the tutorial program, the educational component, meeting with parents and teachers, and teachers, and some of those same parents are now involved in the meeting of Western Addition Community Organization, or WACO, at that time, which we were involved in very much for the next 2 years. So that year, that building coalition, really, whether we did it consciously or unconsciously, set the groundwork for the massive community support we received during the strike. And a number of the guys who, and women who had been were part of the BSU, had been a part of SNCC. Some had been a part of SNCC, so they were organizers themselves. So they knew how to strategically organize. So those were kind of things that I think, for me, were amazing learning experience that those 3 years through the strike, and then the post after the strike, when they basically dismantled the BSU. And I think I was at that time, in my last year, I was the chairman of the Black Student Union at that time, and dismantled the strike, and that the strike dismantled the whole union, and everybody went off in the various ways. But I started off talking about my family, and then they had to talk to kind of like all those things that kind of like were the fabric. I thought with the experience that I'd had those 3 years in community, that the work that I would do would be in community development. Mm-hmm. Basically it, you know. So I came, I did a planning internship at the Berkeley City Planning Department in the fall, in the summer of 1971 after I finished. And then I went to, came to the Office of Community Development in the Model Cities Program in January 1972. And it was another kind of moment. Now I'm dealing with real issues. You know, I've been dealing with people on the ground who are mobilizing and organizing in a moment, what I would call an imaginative moment of grassroots democracy. You know, all these leaders that came out of that, primarily women, people like Eloise Westbrook, who just passed away at 96 years old last year, or Espinola Jackson, or all the other women who came in and were part of this program and were the foundation of this program. A number of them had also known my parents because of you know, that small community and the black community often intersected in relationship to the unions and other things that happened. All those were the kind of the foundation. So there was plenty of not only my family directly, you know, my parents as union workers, postal employees, but also the kind of relationships that would happen in a city like San Francisco, in a community like San Francisco. And each of those dynamics that were happened, whether it was the gentrification of the Western Addition. Western Addition, if you knew it, was the two communities that lived side by side in the Western Addition were the Japanese community and the African American community. And all of this had been, this has been the center for all the activities. And my dad came of age in that period of time. So there was a place where you had all these clubs, small clubs that played, that were places for jazz, you know, where jazz musicians came and spent a lot of time. Before even North Beach came about, and other clubs came up in that area. But it was this great space for music, you know. You see pictures of a young John Coltrane playing in the Fillmore. Then you had the big place, you had the Booker T. Washington Hotel, where all the big band, the Basie band would come, or the Ellington band would come, or all the other big bands would come there as well. So you had all this kind of richness within the community. This is all the community. I remember when my dad, he loved that community. My dad, he had a friend, his name Stoney, who had a small bar that you had to walk down, sub-basement bar that you had to walk down to the basement. And every time he would take me to the hospital, to the doctor, at the old Stanford Hospital, which is in the black community, was in that, was born in the Japanese community. And every time he'd take that, he stopped by his, we'd walk down the street and we stopped by his friend's bar and he'd hang out there for a little bit for the afternoon. So it was that kind of, the kind of richness that came to be, was a part of my life. And I said, the legacy and history of activism in San Francisco, from Harry Bridges, the great union leader and organizer of dock workers, and to all the things, the church, Third Baptist Church. If Dr. King came to San Francisco, first place he went was Third Baptist Church. Church is just celebrating his 150th year of existence right now, and all that. Yeah.
Well, Danny, I mean, this has been great to sort of get that background. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I think, you know, folks in this audience, I'm looking at a pretty diverse group, people have probably different images of you based upon different films or different decades. But one thing that I want to talk to you about, because I've always wondered, even though I know that you have been a longtime labor activist, is how that came about. Because I've known Danny because I'm part of, we used to work for the AFL-CIO and now I'm at the ILR school. So I know Danny has this amazing commitment to workers and worker rights. Uh-huh. But given the fact that there are so many issues out there and so many things that you could put your activism in that you do, it was always interesting to me that the issues of worker rights and labor rights, you know, rose to the top. Mm-hmm. Because there are so few folks who publicly talk about worker issues and worker rights issues. And so I'd really like to know, and I'd love this audience to better understand, like, where did your activism for labor come from? And maybe what are some of the most exciting, interesting campaigns that you've been a part of?
Well, I mean, certainly those campaigns came about with my relationship with Bruce Rayner and the opportunities that we had from Pueblo, Mexico, about 11 years ago, almost 11 years ago, to the work that we've been able to do with Sodexo, or whether the work that we've been able to do around Hugo Boss, or I remember traveling around to about 7 or 8 cities around Hotel Workers Rising, you know, or just recently the campaign of janitors in Houston. Houston needs a raise, you know, which is an incredible metaphor for people, a way in which people were able to come together. That's what I saw. In part of this acculturation, and I mean, my parents and my mother coming from the rural South, my father coming from the Midwest in Kansas City, and the moment they received those jobs at the post office in 1948, the year after the federal workforce was desegregated, the moment they received those jobs, and certainly, all I remember is that when that becomes a part of your life, so much of your life centers around that, whether it was the union picnics that we went on, you know, and the connection between all the peoples, or the way in which you listen to and hear discussions vicariously as you listen to them. In fact, I remember when I took typing in the second grade and learned to type and everything, and became pretty proficient at typing in the seventh grade. I was the one that used to type out the labels for the union newsletter that went out. You know, you know, back in the day, you had to type out each label and everything else on there, and type at each level. And when I would do that, my mom and dad would recruit me to do that. I would do that, then I would be in the midst of a conversation that was really that I'm listening to that had been part of an conversation ushered in to our household. So when I watched the Montgomery bus boycott happening at like 8 years old, you know, I'm like not only watching it myself and looking at the people involved in it, I'm also surreptitiously taking in my parents' view of it as they celebrate that, as they cheer on, as they move on. It's amazing when you think about that. So at each point in time, my parents' involvement elevated me to a different kind of consciousness, you know, by the growth of their own consciousness and own engagement. That in itself was something that I, and of course, I'm the oldest child. So on the one hand, my parents, as the oldest child, were the people I wanted to emulate, you know. And when I saw them celebrate what I was celebrating through my 8-year-old mind and everything, and looking at these events and everything else, I knew that there was a relationship, a much deeper relationship. My father was involved in the union, his union, for 10, 15 years after he retired. He maintained that. He would always wear his union pin. He'd always have his union pin. And my dad was a meticulous dresser. So, I mean, he was fastidious in his dress, man. He'd always have his union pin there, whatever he was wearing. So those are the kind of things that settled in with me. And so their learning and growth cycle, or arc, in some ways mirrored my own, allowed my own to come out. And it, when I had the opportunity, whenever I had the opportunity, and I keep talking about the relationship with Bruce, because Bruce and I have been able to, Bruce has pulled me into some things, and I've been able to pull Bruce into some things, and it's been quite special in terms of that. And because it has allowed me to not only contextualize my experiences, those past experience and how I've seen history over this very extraordinary moment in my lifetime, but also in working with unions now, begin to kind of draw on what I believe to be some of the things and sensibilities and some of the obstacles and challenges we have in the future as well. You know, so it definitely starts with the parent. And if you can, I don't know if you can imagine the energy as I imagined it as a child, whether it was finding the extraordinary brotherhood and sisterhood at a union picnic. It was something else in something at a union picnic. And to find that people felt that they were really changing their lives within their workplace and within their community was extraordinary, you know, to feel at them that they were making decisions. You know, I told somebody that I first heard about the human revolution in 1959 when the union was celebrating the victory of the Cuban Revolution in January 1959. The union of postal employees in San Francisco was celebrating that victory in 1959. And these were primarily African Americans. So they had, in some sense, been had grown and understood not only the issues around the Cuban Revolution, boom, but also the independence of Ghana and the independence of other African countries that subsequently happened as well. So that was a very, 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 I think, the first part of this acculturation itself. Then to be able to follow, you know, to follow as a kid, you know, to follow SNCC, you know. When SNCC came into existence, I was like 14 years old, you know, and to talk about it. We used to be able to talk about it. I mean, I had friends of mine in high school. I mean, I did well in math, poorly in every other subject, but in everything, to be there and to listen to people talk about what was happening with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, being part of that conversation as a high school student was important. In San Francisco was vital, vital.
How did then become there's an activism for art that you're really committed to. How did that come about? I mean, I'm sort of thinking much later when that enters my consciousness, where you know you make a film like To Sleep With Anger Happen, and now you work with Louverture Films, but sort of that trajectory to sort of advocate for art to sort of make you know films happen that are different from what Hollywood puts out, for instance.
Well, it started with theater. I never saw myself as a film actor. Because I never approached it from that vantage point. When you said, I remember a friend of mine, I remember when I did a play by Fugard, a small production in 1976. My friend and I, someone that I, Ben Guillory and I had grown up together, and we had been hippies together, you know. I've lived in a commune, and I was part of a commune network, so all those particular things were part of my life. But Ben was at ACT, the American Conservatory Theater, doing its full-time program. And I came there at night. So I was working in sales for the city during the day and going to classes at night. And that summer in 76, Ben said, hey, let's work on, like all actors do, and if there's any actors in who aspiring actors in the witch company, let's work on a monologue. Let's work on a scene. You know, you're constantly somewhere. What are you doing in this scene? You're always looking for opportunities in which you can challenge yourself, you know? So Ben said, I got this play by Athol Fugard, The Blood Knot. Let's work on some monologues, and great monologues. If you like great monologues. I have a friend of mine, a young actor in Washington, D.C., who's the son of a friend of mine, and he's going to production of The Blood Knot, and I'm going to kind of be the dramaturg on that in some sense, but we started working on monologue. Then we started working on scenes. Then we said, okay, let's pull somebody in who we think who can organize this for us, and we could just keep going. Then we ended up organizing this the whole play. I got music from Dolla Brand, music from Mary McCabe, music from Hugh Masekela, music from Leta Mbula, and then we organized this and did this, a little production where we invited our families, about 25 people in the audience. We kept them hopefully engaged for 4 hours on stage, while we were on stage for 4 hours, you know. And it was those kind of moments that really now saying that, that something is happening. At the same time, I was involved in the African Liberation Support Committee as well, 1975, 1976. So when they came for, the Eureka Theater was doing Sizwe Banzi Is Dead. And that's where I met Carl Lumley in 1977. And Carl Lumley and I did Sizwe Banzi Is Dead. That's where her mother and I worked with the African Liberation Support Committee.
I actually remember that production.
Yeah?
I remember that.
Yeah. And so we did that play, and we found an opportunity to do fundraisers, you know? We would do a fundraiser, and we would have people who were supporting of ZANU, Zimbabwean African National Union, who would come in, and we'd throw a fundraiser for ZANU, have people bring clothes and everything else, and we ship those things and get those things shipped to ZANU or medicals and everything else, the donations and everything else. So I was able to use the art itself, learn from the art and use that self, the art itself for practical purposes in that sense. And that was the real, then I began to, that was another part of my life. Well, you don't know, you still think you're gonna do theater. In your mind, you think you're going to theater. Then things happen in a way that you end up in New York, and you end up in Los Angeles, you end up in New York, and then all of a sudden now, you have to make decisions. The industry itself defines what it's going to do, how it's going to do, and if it's going to make Color Purple, it's going to make Color Purple regardless of me being in it, you know? If it's going to make Silverado, it's going to make Silverado regardless of me, a place in the heart. Now I begin to think about what are the things that I want to do? What are the stories that I want to tell? How do I begin to shape that? So I begin to think about that. That becomes a part of what you're thinking. What do I want out of this? What do I want as a part of my legacy in terms of this business that I did at? And that, and invariably, those ideas were ideas that came about, as I say, with certainly a wonderful kind of collaboration that I've had with people and the people who've come into my life, you know, whether it's Carolyn McDonald, who ran my company for a while, or or whether it's now Jocelyn Barnes, who has been remarkable in terms of that. We started out I started out on a film, doing a film, a small role for a friend of mine, a director from Mali named Sheikh Ahmad Sissoko, who did a movie called Gimba and Genesis and everything else. He asked me to do a small cameo in his movie, and what happens is that I meet this extraordinary woman who has her own story. In fact, she is the great niece of Juna Barnes. You know, is a great niece, and when a great aunt died, bequeathed her the galleys for James Joyce's Ulysses, and she didn't believe that anybody should own that, so she donated it to I think the University of Maryland, which has it in her. So I had this extraordinary woman who had written a script and who had found the money, who had translated the script, adapted the script, it was in French, adapted the story about beggars who go on strike in this fictitious government in West Africa who's being told that they have to confine beggars because of the structural adjustments that have been imposed on them. So we do this film. And then we sit up one night talking about doing a film on the Haitian Revolution. And all of a sudden it lit up. And that was 13 years ago. And we've been in each other's life since then, you know? And we started with the Haitian Revolution, then we said, okay, there's something else that's happening here. So we ended up I love Dura Mensah-Sako's work. So we ended up doing producing and putting money into Bamako, or the Africa Unite around Bob Marley. I mean, Bob Marley has an influence on all of our lives, you know, so much, you know. For me, I saw Bob Marley in his first tour in 1975 here in San Francisco, his first tour of the U.S. tour. I saw Bob Marley and couldn't get enough of him. Saw him every time I could see him and everything. So those are the kind of things that draw together, you piece together those particular things in your cultural life, you know, I see. So, I mean, Jocelyn is, I mean, we produce three Palestinian films we've been producers on. You know, Anna Marie Jashour, the first Palestinian woman to direct a feature film, Salt of the Sea. She has a film that we're producers on, When I Saw Her, which is just at Toronto Film Festival. We were producers on Ilya Suleiman, arguably one of the great directors in the world, The Time That Remains. And we were producers on a Thai film by Apichat Pong, Uncle Bumni, who recalls his past life. And it won the Palme d'Or 3 years ago at the film festival. We got the rights to Adura Manu Muniz's epic novel, called City of Salt, which was the Bedouin community before oil was discovered, begins there. We got the rights to one of the great novels written in Africa, post-colonialism, Usman Sembeni's God's Bits of Wood, which is about a railway strike and from Dakar, on the Dakar-Bamako line in 1947, it changed the whole complexion of the decolonization movement. So those are kind of the way we're thinking about this and all that. The idea of a relationship we thought was phenomenal between Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein. a great deal of it, we're going to use our creative license. But the idea of these two men, these two giants of the 20th century, coming together, that's the kind of way in which we've tried to shape my work. And in an industry, the space is we did Buffalo Soldiers in my previous company, Buffalo Soldiers, which is an idea that my younger brother came to me with to do Buffalo Soldiers, and Freedom Song, which is a script that I thought was going to be done as a feature film, and they couldn't put the money together, so I kept tracking it. And after I did Buffalo Soldiers, I had an opportunity now, because we did so well with TNT, to go to them and pick up the rights to Freedom Song and do Freedom Song. And what comes out of that? I get a chance to meet one of my heroes when I was a kid, Bob Moses, you know? And they have become involved in the Algebra Project, and since have been involved in the project. And say, all these things have their own relationship of building. And certainly, with no credit and from everybody, including your mom, and I had to give it up to him, Bellevue Rooks. It's been an important part of my life. We grew up in the same church together, you know, and we were at San Francisco State together. And we've been involved in the African Liberation Community, our support committee together. And she created this kind of space for me to grow. And even through her own growth, it was challenging my growth as well.
Hmm. Yeah. Should we open? I think we should. We have lots of questions, so if y'all are shy, we're happy to jump right on in there. I think there's somebody up front here. She's going to run down here with the microphone so that I think that you can be heard on the tape, on the streaming.
Okay.
It's on.
Okay, thank you for this opportunity. I'm glad that you mentioned Sam Ben Usman, because I was going to have a question about you, about him. But I'm going to ask you a question about the oil spillages in the Niger Delta. Yesterday, we watched a moving and intelligent documentary by a Nigerian filmmaker about the environmental devastation in that region. I don't know to what extent are you interested in that issue, or if you have ever been interested in that issue. Thank you.
Absolutely, I've had some information and knowledge of what's happening in the Delta. I had met Ken Sawewu. I haven't done enough in terms of the issues around the Niger Delta and what has happened there, but certainly, absolutely, you know. I don't know, as I'm saying, that the filmmakers have come to us and we've used that filmmaking. What we do in terms of all the films that we've done is that we build some sort of platform in which we are able to target an audience and find that audience and begin to use any means possible to kind of create a way in which the film recoups its investment. So now, it may be that we hadn't been contacted about this filmmaker, you know, and we're overloaded now with the work that we're doing now. It's a small step, and a lot of the people in this audience know the history of how we've pulled and pushed and tried to keep this staff together and to keep this company together. Building this company while at the same time creating a particular niche in terms of the filmmakers and the films that we want to support. We're in the midst of doing some exciting things, creating some exciting vehicles to help producers and filmmakers on the continent itself. You know, and that's something that we're not able to reveal right now. But there's certain things that we're possibly going to do that's going to make it easier for filmmakers to tell their stories, and to tell those stories which are connected to their real lives through documentaries primarily, and also through narratives as well.
Yes, Eric.
First, I want to thank you for coming. It's an honor to be in your presence. I've heard you talk a lot, for example, on Democracy Now!, different things about your activism, and I've known about it even prior to that. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you've been able to navigate with the activism that you've done throughout your life in Hollywood and do the stuff you have, and how do you overcome some of the barriers that I'm assuming is there, given, I would imagine, the conservative environment of Hollywood?
How do I overcome what now?
How are you able to navigate through Hollywood in doing what you're doing in order to maintain your activism? Because I see you as a strong activist, and I can only imagine that you've had to navigate through a lot of different changes in order to do what you're doing, and probably had a lot of barriers that have been put in front of you.
Well, I tell you, for the most part, if I sat around kind of deconstruct in some sense my life in terms of what is happening in this industry, you know, I'd be shaking my head and rubbing my head and scratching my head forever. So I don't spend a lot of time. I don't spend actually no time doing that, you know? And, you know, the one thing that I was fortunate, and I'm saying, let me tell you this. When I was doing The Throne for Guard in 1976, 1975, 1976, and everything else, and that period of time, and ended up on Broadway with Master Harold and the Boys in 1982. My journey from there had basically now mirrored the journey of public discourse and consciousness about South Africa anyway. So I was in a popular and important play under a situation that people were actually talking about. They had already identified an iconic leader in that, in Nelson Mandela. They had already talked about divestment. They had talked about all the particular things that had galvanized communities, from university communities to faith-based communities to the public sector all over. People were talking about this. So I was right on the work that I happened to do, happened to mirror the ascension of these ideas and everything else. So all that I was able to do, our work was able to kind of accentuate it in some way. But the public outcry, not only in this country, but worldwide around the apartheid system, had reached a certain crescendo by 1982 and was building even more. Ron Dellums had brought embargo legislation to the Congress year after year. From 1972, whenever he came to Congress, year after year, finally that signed into agreement after I think 1988. Alfred Woodard and I had done Mandela in 1986. 4 years later, we had done Mandela, and that we used that as a platform to organize and with Denzel Washington and Blair Underwood became the founders of Artists Against Apartheid. So all those particular things, the public discourse had pushed that, and that's important and understood. So you say art comes out of this kind of also public space that creates the public space for the acceptance of certain ideas and everything. And of the movement of those ideas. So it's clear to understand that. So when we think about that now, as we move forward, as we think about Occupy, and we think about 99 and 1% and all of the things, and we think about what we can do. Some of the greatest plays were written. We talk Waiting for Lefty, Awake and Sing, all those about workers, you know what I'm saying? All those about immigrants. Some of those great plays that were written and performed at a time when men and women were engaged in the struggle, in labor struggles. So that work came out of the group theater. All that work came out of real people's lives and real people's experience. So imagine that moment being carried into that. And certainly carried into, if you see, me going from Places in the Heart in 1982 to Broadway 1982 with Master Harold and the Boys, going to 1983 with Places in the Heart. Places in the Heart took me directly to Witness, to Silverado, and The Color Purple. And so by the time I got to Color Purple, I had now become, they had doing, I think, very good work and everything else that at by Color Purple that led to Lethal Weapon. And Lethal Weapon became a franchise. And for that moment was the franchise. I can think about what are the other things that I want to do. The moment it became a franchise, I began to say, so how do we navigate through this? So we did The Saint of Fort Washington with me and Matt Dillon about two homeless men about there. It was a story that we were trying to push. We couldn't get any leverage on that until Warner Brothers wanted me to do the third Lethal Weapon they'd expressed a certain time period to do that third Lethal Weapon. And then he said, oh, we want to do it earlier. I said, but I can't do it earlier. I have another commitment. And this is our little you know, dance we're doing, our little chess play. Well, what's the other commitment? I said, we have another commitment on a film that we're just about ready to settle the financing on. But you've already seen the script already. It's my agent. You already seen the script. Saint of Fort Washington. You remember that? Oh, let's see it again. So all of a sudden, they want to see it again. They want to now. They'll put up half the money if I do Lethal Weapon at that particular point in time when they want it, and then push back and do The Saint of Paul Washington after that. So that kind of leverage I was able to use to do this America's Dreams with HBO. With Mandela, I formed a great relationship with HBO, and I was able to usher in things that I wanted to do with HBO, but they were always centered on what I wanted to do and everything else. And it all comes its own time, because I wish I had the same leverage I had then that I have now. You're talking about the things we would do at Louverture. We're just at Louverture Films, boy. If we had the same leverage that I had, say, in 1990, you know, to be able to do that, you know. But in 1990, you know, I was, you know, 44 years old, you know what I'm saying? It's a different time. But I know something has happened, of course, you know. But I tell you, there's a community that's been out there, that there's a community in world cinema that is so exciting and so dynamic, you know, and the possibility Jocelyn and I have been able to kind of look at work of young filmmakers. In fact, I was just doing I saw five films that we were choosing for this submission and awards, and the five documentaries I saw were just amazing. It was hard to choose which was the number one doc in that WitchCon, but it was just amazing. So those things are happening right now, you know, and whatever the consequences, whatever has happened as a result of whatever my activism or whatever I decide to do, in terms of that, and I had to say this, when I decide that I'm going to support, you know, Nissan workers in Canton, Mississippi, I don't kind of look at, you know, look in, and look at the Gallup polls and decide whether to do that or not, or whether to support that or not, you know, as I've, and I think that the more that what's happening right now among workers, both here and internationally, is critical to however we want to and I'm gonna use the word again, which I've using all day, and tell you, reimagine the possibilities of what we can do as human beings.
Yes, please.
I'd like to thank you for your presentation as well. It's an honor to have you on campus, and it was, is this close enough? And it was an honor to hear you speak. It was great to see, or it seemed pretty clear from your presentation that your work as a student activist was kind of a catalyst for your lifelong commitment to social justice. And what was really interesting about your description of your work as a student on campus was that your activism on campus intersected with how you all were working off campus, and that you were able to really kind of connect those issues. Now, as a student at Cornell, and I think this is for a variety of reasons, which will be another kind of conversation, working on campus and working on issues at our own campus can sometimes not necessarily distract you, but it's hard to do both of those things. It seems that if you are really focused on issues that students are facing on campus, it is sometimes hard to connect that with larger issues in the world or even in the Ithaca community. And the other added factor is that there's a lot of work to be done just as a student in terms of schoolwork. So I guess what I would like to know is, what I would like to know is what your advice is to students now on this campus, how we can best position ourselves and develop ourselves to be able to engage in the struggle for social justice given those issues that we're facing.
Well, I thank you for that question. And I don't want to be presumptuous enough to tell you what you should be doing. You know, I don't, in no way would I want to be that. But I think the fact that you elevate that question, the question now, and that you know that there's a relationship between what is happens on your own campus. And a campus, this certainly has changed differently from the campus that I was on more than 40 years ago. You know, whether it be Cornell or whether it be San Francisco State, whether it be the University of California, you know. And certainly what happens on campus is reflected in what is happening in terms of movement building outside of the campus itself. The issues that when we were at the University of Wisconsin, and Bruce and I were at the University of Wisconsin. We came and met with students who were involved in the issues around workers, you know, around workers who were workers. I'm trying to find a term. Tell me, Bruce. Laundry workers. They were connected with laundry workers, but they also were connected with workers who were the other term that I want to use for workers who are unorganized workers, but not unorganized workers, but that often we use the term, and I can't think of the term right now. But they were mounting a campaign in support of workers. Right there on campus, the workers there who were there on the campus and approximate to the campus, but also connecting that information and connecting that struggle internationally as well. So the fact is that the movements are happening around us in this sense. How do we kind of, what we try to do is say, this campus is not the ivory tower. It is not isolated from what happens in the community. It is not isolated in what happens in the community. And in fact, the role that we play is the role is where we become the interlocker between who we are as students and what is happening in the community. And I think those are still important elements. How that works out and how that dynamic works out in the work choices or the work methodology, the way in which you approach it, or decisions that you're going to make. But I'm sure that there's going to be, there are opportunities there, whether we find those opportunities to finding doing in support of other students around the world, whether we're supporting Chilean students who went out on strike, you know, or other students around the world. We can find that which is specific to our particular struggle, and I'm saying yours particular struggle here in Ithaca, wherever we can, and make those connections. Because I think your work within that framework, within that context, is inexplicably tied into the work that you end up doing, the choices you end up making as you go out into the world and into your communities after you finish university.
Yes, sir.
I also appreciated your work in the TV Civil War series. I appreciated that very much. Anyway, Danny, suppose we were to play in the act of being 1/7 billion members of an African family. Would that play win an Academy Award?
The what now?
Suppose all humanity were an acting troupe of being one acting family, one African family. Uh-huh. Would that play win an Academy Award?
Okay. Well, you tell me there is a play?
Oh, no. I'm saying we're all basically African and one African family.
Oh, of course, yes.
Okay. Now, if that were a play, would that play win an Academy Award? If we were able to bring off that play, living as one African family, could that win an Academy Award?
Well,
if so, Danny, here's your Oscar right here, my
book. Oh, okay. All right. There we go right there. There you go. It's difficult to say, you know, making films, it's quite intriguing. The storytelling itself, and there's so many creative ways in which people go out and find out the organized and telling the stories, and a play in itself or a film in itself has what I think intended consequences and unintentional consequences. And so then often, when you're constructing a story, you know, let's take for an example of the story that I've been working on for nearly 30 years almost, on an idea of the Haitian Revolution. Let's take the example of that, you know. Now, all the information that you would need in research is within the public domain. But how do you now shape the story around values, with intent, around values that not only reflect those moments in that part of history, but also, in some sense, ignite or enliven the ideas of those who are the byproducts of 200 years later, us today. And in one way in which we had tried to approach the story was not to give people a history lesson, but try to imagine, in a sense, the historical personal dynamics or contradictions and the struggles among those engaged within that struggle. And it takes it a form, in the form of saying, if I say that I believe, and others may be different, so you had to be strong about your own belief. If I believe that Toussaint is the center of this idea right now, then what are the kind of contradictions that Toussaint has to deal with in this evolution? If the contradiction is outside of just the historical sequences, is the contradiction between modernity and traditionalism, and then he's battling internally, emotionally, psychologically, those forces. I ground him in some sort of way. I ground the story in a different way. And I began to shape the story around those ideals and those outcomes. And you could be very well, I could be off base in terms of telling the story. I can hit right at the center of it where people begin to take the Haitian Revolution and understand the Haitian Revolution as in what the role it played at this point in the evolution of history, and also personify that in certain ways in which it is they're able to take away from the lessons that they may be able to use today. in the sense. So there's a way in which that becomes, I believe, for my sensibility within the, governs my sensibility within the structuring and trying to structure storytelling.
Yeah. We'll take one more. Yes, this. We'll take it, okay. Yes, go ahead.
Going off of you're talking about the Haitian Revolution.
I'm sorry.
Talking about the Haitian Revolution movie that you're working on, Toussaint. I wanted to know how you were talking about how to bring that to like a, make it a new story for like a modern generation. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how you also want to incorporate. You're working on like an international cooperation among all Caribbean nations. So I wanted to know how you want to also like. Not only tell the Haitian Revolution story, but tell like a Caribbean story.
I'm sorry, the Haitian Revolution what?
How do you want to take the Haitian Revolution story and make it not only about Haiti and recognizing their struggles, but like the Caribbean itself and international cooperation?
I don't know if that's specific. I mean, certain people choose to do that. Take one story and use as a platform to talk about something that's contemporary. That's not what I was saying, in some sense. I was saying that within each story are the personal and collective choices that people make. And the choices that make, the decisions that they make, how do I find the space to know? We know that something happened in 1791, and over the next 13 years during someone's life, these changes created at this particular point, aroused certain emotions in people, certain expectations in people. We understand that in a sense. So we understand that the Haitian Revolution, while it's the culmination of one period in Haitian history, it's the beginning of another period in the Haitian's history, Haiti's history. So how do you begin to shape the story that Toussaint is a human being, first of all, making choices of somebody who's fallible, someone who's not perfect with everything, but making choices at this particular point. And each of those choices did not, in some sense, attempt to create him as this invincible, heroic image or whatever, but each of those choices are human choices. At the point that he starts to begin one part of this journey, in some sense, reluctant to some extent, he's 47 years old when he becomes involved in the struggle itself. When the conflict breaks out, he's 47 years old. So here's someone who's gained certain advantages of being a part of this system, being a coachman, being someone who lived and had certain favors, the Breda. Toussaint Breda is his name. He has a royal lineage from Benin. He has all these kind of things that work into his own consciousness as he begins to see not only the conflict evolving and the changing nature of that conflict and the opportunity available at that conflict as well, as that conflict emerges that, as well. You know, so those are the kind of things that then the choices that he makes. The choices where, in assuming this responsibility of leadership, the choices that he makes within that, as a human being, as someone who would sit back at the beginning after all is falling apart and realize and be able to look at himself. And those are the kind of characters, the kind of characterization that I like, that I want to make. From that point of becoming someone who's ordinary to becoming something extraordinary in the mission itself, and then finds that him himself has been has himself done both good and bad, you know, in the process, you know. So how do you tell that story?
So the last question is Loxley's.
Welcome, my brother.
Huh?
Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
In terms of American popular culture, your reputation, you probably would be characterized as an actor, film producer, who does some activism on the side.
I'm sorry?
You'd probably be characterized in the context of American popular culture as an actor or film producer who does some activism on the side.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could well be characterized as an activist who does some acting and film producing on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if any of these characterizations sum you up, or do you have an alternative?
I tend to think of myself as a citizen artist. So, I tend to think about myself from that vantage point as a citizen artist. And certainly, some people come into this business and there's some sort of context for them as they move through and navigate through this industry. I'm not going to pretend to know all the ins and outs of it. I think in the succession of films that I've been able to do, that I think I've grown as an actor in my craft. I would say that. I explained to that. All the other kind of machinations about how you do this and how you do that within the film, where I'm probably sometimes clueless because they are dynamic and always changing. But at the same time, what dictates my life is not what scripts or how many scripts I read. What dictates my life and is the foundation and grounding for me is the work that I do as a human being and part of being a part of a human family and being a citizen. That in itself is essentially the bottom line in everything else. The bottom line in that is that, in terms of that. It has governed my own sensibilities. It has allowed me to be, I would have to say, more passionate about life and possibility than anything that I've done in films. You know what I'm saying? In that sense, that's the bottom line in that sense, you know? And sometimes I'd wake up in the morning thinking that I gotta be somewhere in which something's happening in the world and I'm gonna hear something in the world that I'm gonna be a part of, that I have a chance, has an opportunity to get us closer and move us closer to a world. A different world. And that's where, when I wake up in the morning thinking that. When I wake in the morning, pull up a newspaper, it's not the entertainment section. It's not Variety. That's not the first thing I look at in the morning. It's not the first thing. First thing is I look at is what I'm going to read, just going and what I'm going to, what's going to come into my life to make me understand and be able to handle all the things that we collectively have to deal with as we move to each stage we in changing the world. That's it, you know, whether it's coming here, whether it's talking to students, which is a part of that, whether it's talking to those children, as I sat in the chair and I sat on the floor, which is a part of that, or whether it's preparing to go and meet a group of workers with Bruce Rayner at Hugo Boss, or a group of workers at the Hilton or whatever. All those, in some sense, are the meat or the substance that is my the key or the space to my own sensibilities about life, and my own maturation and growth. Yeah.
On that inspirational note, we'd like to thank Danny Glover for sharing his life and work with us. Thank you very much to Mark Noluwe and Sabine as well. Thank you again. Thank you all.
Thank you.